I want to talk about the basic issues. I want to raise many, many, many questions. What are chemical germicides? Because it's a very heterogeneous group here. There are people from marketing and so on may not have had exposure to some of the technical aspects. So let me bring them to a common ground before we get started with some of the key issues. Then I'll talk about the safety concerns and how do we actually assess germicidal activity, which we know a little bit about, and then are product labels clear and meaningful? And the simple answer to that is no, and what are my concerns, and how can manufacturers, in fact, address what I indicate as potential problems? Are current regulations satisfactory? Again, a simple answer to that question is no, and then I will give you my perspective on that. And what do I regard as desirable qualities in a chemical germicidal product? And again, this is a list coming from the perspective of an academic, but I like to indicate to you that over these years we have made a special effort to work with manufacturers very, very closely. So even though, as Professor Engle once said, we people, professors at universities, sit in our ivy-covered ivory towers, we have developed, or at least I have tried to develop, a perspective on this issue, which is unique because we, as I said, work with regulators, manufacturers, end users on a constant basis, and of course we are basically researchers ourselves. So this is something that is absolutely unique, and I will give you what I consider would be desirable qualities in a chemical germicidal product. And if there are these issues that I am going to be pointing out, where can manufacturers bring in their own expertise to try and address some of these issues? And then what does the future hold? Is this a hopeless situation? Are there issues that, in fact, can be tackled simply? And how would one approach the future in terms of getting some of these issues addressed? Now, chemical germicides, there are many, many ways to define them, but very, very simply defined, it's a single chemical or a mixture of chemicals that are formulated to destroy disease-causing microorganisms, and one uses colloquially the term germs. Some people don't like that term, but it has become a part of our vocabulary, and I have no resistance to continuing to use the term germ, therefore germicides. In that category, there are several, in that particular, under that particular umbrella, there are several categories. You have sanitizers. Sanitizer is a term which is a favorite of copywriters because it's a very impressive term. It doesn't say very much in reality. As long as you can clean something, make it look shiny and make it smell good, it's been sanitized without any regard to as to whether it in fact has had any potential disease-causing germs destroyed or removed from it. But so be it. We are not going to try and change that because it's too well ingrained in our vocabulary. Disinfectants, our major concern here, in fact, are designed and are used in several categories to try and destroy disease-causing germs, and we will come to that in a moment. Chemisterilants is a category within disinfectants where the expectation is that chemisterilant would be able to kill all known classes of human pathogens or even animal pathogens. I can tell you without any hesitation that I do not like this term, and I'm again carrying on a crusade to try and have it phased out, because a liquid chemical sterilant, there is no such thing. Because if you treat something in a liquid chemical sterilant, the moment you take it out, it is no more sterile. The way you use it on a patient, for example, it is not used in a sterile manner, as opposed to something that has been autoclave sterilized or has been sterilized in an ETO, ethylene oxide sterilization unit. So liquid chemical sterilants is a bit of a misnomer, and then again, if time permits, I'd be happy to discuss that. Antiseptics are germicides that are applied on living skin or mucous membranes, and again, there are certain categories and issues within that which go from hand washing agents right up to those that are used by surgeons as pre-scrubs before they go on to perform surgeries. In Europe, particularly, the term microbicide or microbiocide are more commonly used. They are a class of biocides. As the name indicates, a biocide is a chemical that kills living things, and it could be anything from a plant to an animal to a microorganism. And this term is being pushed as a more scientific way of classifying these or terming these products rather than the use of the term germicide. Sometimes antimicrobials is also used, but antimicrobials one has to be careful, because if you're not talking about it in the right context, antimicrobials could include antibiotics as well, which is not a part of our discussion at all. So one needs to qualify as to why one would use antimicrobials if one insists on using it. Why are chemical germicides needed? Well, they're needed to kill disease-causing agents. But is there a problem with disease-causing agents? I'll give you a very quick perspective of what the situation is, and then we can see the issues with regards to the relevance of chemical germicides. These are data, latest data available from the World Health Organization. If you look at the pie chart, nearly 25% of deaths that occur globally are due to infectious diseases. But that is really a misrepresentation, in the sense that infectious agents also are involved, directly or indirectly, causing many fatalities which are grouped together under cardiovascular disorders. They are involved in many kinds of respiratory and digestive disorders as well. And then they are increasing being incriminated in many types of cancers. So if you, in fact, take that general scenario into account, it is estimated that infectious agents may be responsible for nearly one-third of fatalities that are reported or recorded on a global basis. And that's a significant number by anybody's imagination. So infectious diseases are a problem. They are not dead. In fact, in some cases, they are coming back with a vengeance. There are several reasons for it. And again, if time permits, we can discuss as to why our societies are becoming more vulnerable to many types of infectious agents that were not a problem before, and that how we are discovering new infectious agents where we are recognizing their role, where their role was never suspected up until recently. Again, looking at the same story, according to the World Health Organization, and because our group represents a global company, I don't want to focus entirely on the North American perspective or the U.S. or Canadian perspective, but give you a broader perspective into what is known about the impact of infectious diseases in the world. Low-income countries, the number of people who die, as they are recorded in terms of the cause of death, 45% are due to infectious diseases or infectious agents. In the worldwide, younger children, nearly 63% of their fatalities can be ascribed to infectious agents. And then if you look at the economic impact, not just people who die, 400 million disability adjusted life years lost. That means that a person who could live to be 65 years of age is dying at 30 years of age, the number of years of his life that are lost as a result of this infection is taken into account in calculating the economic impact of it. At the same time, we are discovering new infectious agents all the time. No week goes by without there being a report of either a new virus or a bacterium having been discovered as a cause of infection in a human being or an animal. And we are also finding that diseases that did not have any clear etiology associated with them may in fact be due to certain infectious agents that we have known about for a long time, but we never really investigated enough this relationship with the infectious agent. A good example is that of post-polio syndrome. I'm sure you have heard about it, where poliomyelitis is no more a problem these days, but people who lived in the era where polio epidemics used to take place, apparently healthy, but they never realized that they had an encounter with the poliovirus, because what they had was a subclinical infection. But now when they are growing older, their musculature is weakening at a much faster rate than age alone could explain. And when you look at statistically, it is suggested that their apparently mild infections when they were children are now coming to haunt them in a sense, and that this is regarded as post-polio syndrome. And it's a major problem in certain communities. So infectious diseases are appearing in many guises. We also are discovering not only drug-resistant microorganisms such as MRSA and VRE and multi-drug-resistant mycobacterium tuberculosis, but we are also discovering on a very regular basis what are called opportunistic pathogens. These are organisms which live in the environment. They are totally, completely happy living there. They don't need human hosts, but if a human host becomes weak for whatever reason, then they find such a host an opportune host for them to in fact infect and cause or cause disease. A good example of this is Legionnaires' disease. The bacteria that are called Legionella are everywhere in the environment, particularly in the water environment. They don't do anything to normal people, but if you have been debilitated because of age or immunosuppression or cancer chemotherapy or whatever, then you are a sitting target for such infectious agents. So the scope of infectious diseases is in fact increasing as time goes by. Unfortunately, also, we haven't made many significant strides in developing new, effective, safe vaccines, nor have we made tremendous strides in developing new, effective, safe chemotherapeutic agents. The golden era of antibiotics has been long gone. People are working very hard, but they cannot really find good, safe antibiotics similar to what we found in penicillin, for example. Vaccines that have been developed were thought to be breakthroughs. When they started to be used, problems were discovered. So actually, they had to be taken off the market. A good example is that of the vaccine against rotaviral gastroenteritis. It's a major problem of young children. And if the infection is severe enough, the dehydration can, in fact, result in the death of such an affected child. So when rotavirus vaccine was introduced, everybody was very, very happy in that this is the way to actually beat that major killer of children. But they found out that children who had been vaccinated developed a phenomenon called intussusception, where parts of their intestines actually fold on each other. And it's a very painful condition. So now they have had that vaccine removed from the market to, in fact, come up with something safer and better. As I mentioned very, very quickly earlier, that changes in the society are also making us much more vulnerable to certain kinds of infections where we did not have any worries about them causing problems in our midst to any great extent. And I have written quite a bit on this topic, and I have copies of my reviews on this as to why I regard that as an emerging problem, and I'd be happy to share that information with whosoever would like it. Impact of infectious diseases in the U.S. So in the U.S., we are an industrial society. We live in hygienic conditions. So should we worry about infectious diseases, or is this something, a myth or a figment of our imagination? Unfortunately, it is still very much a reality. And it is suggested, these are recent data from the CDC, that 19% of the visits to physicians, and the total number of visits is at least 120 million, are due to infections. They may be a variety of infections. It may be just a common cold, which is not very serious, to something a lot more serious and life-threatening. So infectious diseases have, if not an impact in terms of the number of people that they kill, but an impact in terms of the economy of the country. There is, in fact, an increase in the rate of hospitalization due to infection. This is, again, very recent data where people have looked at figures from several years ago. Foodborne diseases, in fact, are going up in many societies. There are reasons for it, and of course I've given all kinds of background data on the review that came out in the American Journal of Infection Control a couple of years ago. But the numbers of infections due to foodborne pathogens and the number of fatalities is still quite significant, and you cannot ignore it. Now, before I go on to what role germicides play, let me just give you a very quick summary of how infectious diseases spread in a basic, very fundamental manner. Vertical spread is when a pregnant woman gets infected with a bug and that manages to pass that infectious agent to the developing fetus. This happens when a woman has German measles, especially in the first trimester of the pregnancy. And the child, the developing fetus, can either be stillborn or might come up with congenital abnormalities such as eye damage or heart damage, or in fact the hydrocephalus, in which the brain size is swollen because of water retention and so on. There's not much one can do in terms of using chemical germicides, so forget about that. The only way one can prevent vertical infections or vertical spread is by vaccination when it is available, or by educating women to take care of avoiding certain activities such as cleaning up the sandboxes so that they won't get exposed to toxoplasmosis, which is a parasite which can also cause congenital malformation. There is no vaccine against it. It's a preventive measure. So here, chemical germicides, virtually no role to play. However, there is another mode, which is called the horizontal mode. And this is a much more common way of the way infectious agents spread. In the horizontal mode of spread, you have an infected host spreading the infection directly to a susceptible individual, such as during intimate sexual contact. You have sexually transmitted diseases where there is nothing that acts as a medium for the spread of the infectious agent. It goes from the infected individual directly to a susceptible individual during such intimate contact. It doesn't have to be venereal all the time. It can happen between a mother and child in some cases as well. But more commonly, the spread occurs indirectly from the infected to a susceptible host. And in this indirect spread, you have many vehicles that are involved. Food, water, air, fomites are articles of common use. For example, in a daycare center, you might have a number of children playing with the same toys, and if one toy has managed to contaminate that, one child has managed to contaminate that toy, another child playing with it and putting it in his or her mouth is a sure way of transferring infectious agents. And that is a classical example of a fomite or fomites or fomus, depends on which school you belong to. Insects, we know malaria and things such as those, and animals, soils and hand, very, very important. Environmental surfaces, also relatively important. Medical devices and transplanted blood and tissues. With regards to transplanted blood, we have certain measures in which you can decontaminate blood and blood products using physical or chemical means. So germicides are indeed used in making that blood safer for transfusion. In certain cases, tissues can also be decontaminated with chemical germicides before they are transplanted. A good example of this is heart valves from animal origin, which are implanted into human beings. So let's focus on this, and then let's see where chemical germicides might be important in interrupting this transmission. It's, again, a very summary scenario. Imagine an infected host has released from his or her body infectious agents, either in feces or urine or saliva or whatever. If that infectious agent, when it ends up in the environment, manages to not only contaminate the environment, but also manages to survive in that contaminated body or object or surface. Because if it does not survive, then it's not a potential threat, because it just does not live long enough for it to be passed on to a second susceptible person. But survival here is a key issue. And then, once it survived, it can either go from that originally contaminated surface or object to a susceptible host by inoculation. It could be through the mouth, the eyes, or through the skin or whatever. Or it can go from that originally contaminated vehicle to another vehicle, for example, hands contaminating environmental surfaces, and that environmental surface can be the source of the pathogen for that susceptible host. This can result in infection. But you have to recognize the fact that not all infections result in disease. Luckily, only a very small percentage of people who become infected actually develop frank cases of disease where they suffer from fever and rash and so on and so on. So it is fortunate in that not more people become actually sick, but there is a downside to that phenomenon. I'll come to that in a moment. So such an infected person, either diseased or a subclinical case, can then in fact complete the cycle of infection. Now, a lot of these subclinically infected people can be a source of such pathogens to people around them, because then a subclinically infected individual does not take time off, does not go to the hospital, does not stay home to in fact recuperate from that infection. They go to work. A child would then be sent to a daycare center while that child is excreting virus and therefore can become an unwitting source of that contamination to other susceptible people around. So in some cases, perhaps it's better to have a frank case of disease, at least you remain confined. And if you want to read more about the implications of this, then Paul Ewald has written several books and articles on the implications of how this relationship with human beings, whether it becomes a severe infection and a case of disease or a subclinical infection, have implications for the evolution of pathogens amongst human populations. So when this scenario is accepted as a viable way for the infectious agents to spread, then cleaning, disinfection, sterilization can in fact be extremely crucial in breaking this chain. So the objective is to try and destroy or eliminate infectious agents from these parts of vehicles whereby they will not get a chance to go on to the next susceptible host. Therefore, you're interrupting this chain of transmission. So this is what you have to keep in mind to be able to justify within your mind the need for and the proper use of chemical germicides. The need for chemical germicides can interrupt the spread of many types of pathogens. And at the same time, and this may be not altogether a surprise to you, is that the reliance of chemical germicides is actually increasing. This is because we have more immunosuppressed patients in our midst. With the advent of organ transplantation, with the advent of chemotherapy against cancer, with the fact that people are living longer, makes it possible for them to become much more susceptible to infections than would happen in our community some 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we have more vulnerable people around, and then we also have more opportunistic pathogens to worry about. And then we have many infections that we thought had been conquered, they are re-emerging with a vengeance. A good example is that of tuberculosis. Not only tuberculosis has come back, but the organism that causes tuberculosis, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, has developed multi-drug resistance. So in many cases, you can't really do anything about it in treating it. The best way to do it is to carry out interruptive, preventive measures where germicides can play a role. There are societal changes that I've talked about. And then there is increasing resistance to antibiotics. I was surprised to hear some people tell me that in certain hospitals, when people become colonized with methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus on their skin, there was a time when they would be given antibiotics to clear up the colonization on the skin. But if that thing, or methicillin, now that thing is resistant to methicillin, they have to hold that patient for as long as a week, extra time in the hospital, treat them with a germicide-based ointment so that colonization is cleared before that individual could be released into the community. And here is an example of how germicides are playing a role which was not anticipated before the advent of germicide resistance itself. Now, where are chemical germicides used? There is a whole variety of places, and I don't have time to really go into describing each one of these, but let's just focus on what is our major concern here. Environmental surfaces and fomites, and skin, which includes the skin of hands. And I'm not going to talk about pre-surgical scrubs here because that is not the focus as far as these two companies are concerned, but talk about hand washing agents. And they play a very, very important role in interrupting the spread of pathogens. But there are many other places where germicides are used, and there are more and more varieties of germicides that are being introduced for uses in those various categories. But we're using all these germicides. Are there safety concerns? Well, surely there are safety concerns, but you need to, again, be aware of where these safety concerns are coming from. One statement that cannot, will be without any controversy to it, is the fact that germicides are a double-edged sword. They have their good side, but at the same time, they have their bad side. So the trick is to be able to optimize their good qualities while minimizing their bad qualities. And one must remember that no chemical that can kill germs can be totally safe for other life forms. This is without any doubt. Nobody can argue against it. When I see people coming up with formulations which are touted as totally safe, and there are these individuals who are standing there at their booths drinking the stuff or spraying it in their mouth, I get very, very concerned, because either that product is not what it's supposed to be, or if it is, then they're exposing themselves to dangers that are probably kind of unrecognized. The EPA in the United States lists more than 8,000 products which are registered with them. But fortunately, 90% of these products contain 14 different kinds of actives. So we are not dealing with 8,000 different chemicals to worry about. Things are manageable because we have 14 major actives in terms of germicides to focus on. But many of these 14 actives are indeed under attack. And they are under attack because there is a tendency on certain on the part of certain manufacturers to actually oversell germicides. They sell them in places where their use cannot be justified. And then misinformed public and professionals alike. I am dismayed many times to talk to infection control professionals who have years of training, but they are woefully uninformed about what they should be looking for in a chemical germicide. And of course, if you got a fast-talking salesperson, then that's a wonderful target, and they can get away with essentially anything. So one of the things that I keep emphasizing as a part of my center's mission is to have an educated sales force which can talk in real terms, so that the credibility of the company may take a little longer to develop, but that it's on a very solid foundation. And this is where one needs to be aware of the potential problems with regards to the credibility of certain products that are sold, perhaps in a way they're not suited for it. And then people tend to use them in totally irrelevant places. When problems arise, then they recognize that that product wasn't really meant for use in that particular context. There is also developing a backlash. You see this in the popular press or even in the scientific press, the statements, are we getting too hygienic? Is the increase in asthma, for example, because of the fact that we are isolating ourselves from these germs that are around us? And some people have said so in so many words that children should be rolling in dirt because that gives them a higher exposure to pathogens. Therefore, they will be safer when they grow up later on. And I have written letters, angry letters to newspapers and so on to try and bring some sense to this paranoia in effect. But there are schools of thought which would surprise you. There is a professor in Japan, and I'm sure my Japanese friends here will vouch for it, who has come up with the hypothesis that reduction in the number of cases of worm infestations in Japan is the reason for an increase in violence in the Japanese society. And I have his review, and I'm not making this up. what reason he's come up with that relationship is totally, completely beyond me. But you see, when Marshall McLuhan said that the medium is the message, when a professor who has got a reputation begins to talk about these things, people don't think about his logic. They accept the message simply because of the person it's coming from, and that can do a lot of damage. So there are those issues that one needs to be cognizant of. So when you try and sell a product, you say that, Wes, we are aware of the problems, but here is a product that is free from these potential or identified problems that we are discussing. There are many, many hazards in the use of chemical germicides. As I said, no chemical is entirely safe. There are degrees of toxicity. So it is not complete absence of toxicity we are talking about. So when we talk about toxicity to humans, the objective is to minimize that negative aspect and optimize the other good qualities. Damage to the environment, there's no question about it. Chlorine, glutaraldehyde, or even quartz can be potentially damaging to the environment. Therefore, again, you use them in such a way that they do the job when they are needed, but will not get into the environment and cause that damage. So again, that message has to come loud and clear. Corrosion and materials compatibility. This problem isn't entirely the fault of chemical herbicide manufacturers. I think what we have realized over the years that device manufacturers, especially for high-level disinfectants, must work closely with chemical germicide manufacturers so that they make their devices or a material that are more likely to be compatible with the product that is to be used for their decontamination. Right now, that consideration doesn't exist. You might have one brass screw, which is very crucial, to a $25,000 medical device such as an endoscope. The rest of the device is perfectly compatible, but that screw, when it gets corroded as a result of exposure to a particular product, ruins the whole thing, because that gives the bad reputation to the device as well as the product and the hospital where it's been used. And you can be sure that there are legal implications out of that. Volatile organics and air quality, both contexts, outdoor air quality and indoor air quality. With regards to outdoor air quality, we know that certain classes of chemical germicides can contribute to smog. And as Randy was saying earlier, we don't want to talk about what's happening in California, but at the same time, we cannot ignore a state with 30 million people. They are extremely concerned. And as, again, you may or may not be aware of the fact that some 10, 15 years ago, California's Air Resources Board seriously contemplated banning perfumes because they are volatile organics and that they can actually add to smog generation. They are very leery about the use of products based on alcohol, for example, and that's a battle that is ongoing. So one needs to be cognizant about that. And in terms of the indoor air quality, there is an increasing concern because of the people who have multiple chemical sensitivities, people who have asthma. There are now places where houses are designed specially where they don't have any off-gassing or VOCs, so the people with such sensitivities can live without any problems. Another issue, which is perhaps a little more recent, is the potential of certain chemicals to disrupt the functioning of hormones, particularly endocrine hormones. They are called endocrine disrupting substances or endocrine disrupting chemicals, EDS or EDC. If you want to know more about this, I recommend a book very, very highly. It's called Our Stolen Future, written by Theo Kolbern. And I have read that book. I have a copy of it. Some people suggest that that book will eventually have the same impact as The Silent Spring in the early 1960s, written by Rachel Carson. It's a real eye-opener if you really want to know why this concern has emerged. And the EPA has listed several thousand chemicals which they consider as potential endocrine disrupting chemicals, and they're focusing more attention with OECD to try and screen them out so that they can get more information about the potential of such chemicals to disrupt hormone function. And of course, there is this concern about germicides and antibiotic resistance. This data comes from a relatively recent publication. Actually, it came out in the middle of last year from people who are associated with the EPA, suggesting that 800,000 children, young children, get exposed to household pesticides on a regular basis. But what is interesting is that 10% or more of such cases, which are severe enough to require attention, are because of household disinfectants. They don't specify which ones, of course, for obvious reasons, but that 90% of these cases are due to ingestion or exposure to household disinfectant. So what do they recommend? They say we must find safer alternatives. They also go on to say that you should restrict the sales of concentrates because, of course, the higher concentrations, there is more potential for exposure. There are other recommendations in this paper which are kind of naive in my view, in that they suggest adding bittering agents. You can't do that. If you use it in your kitchen, every food items that you will eventually prepare there will probably have that bittering agent in your food. Or they say add coloring agents so that you can see it come out in the urine of the person who has ingested it. I don't think it's really solving the problem. The focus has to be to find safer alternatives. And this is, again, that paper has attracted a lot of attention in the popular press. This is from a recent EPA report where, again, they have taken 10 different chemicals in the work environment and looked at the problems that it has created. And you can see that the four of them in the top ranking are some way or the other chemical germicide. Sodium hypochlorite has given rise to several dozens of cases of illness in workplace settings. Quaternary ammoniums, chlorine gas, and of course glutaraldehyde. This is very well known as a source of problems in settings such as hospitals and so on. Are germicides tested properly? Again, a simple answer is that no. But let me tell you as to why I say they are not. There are many, many, many deficiencies, but my second talk will focus on that topic. Therefore, I'm not going to go into too much detail. Let me just touch upon a few very salient points. The design of many current methods is weak, is either too weak or too strong. If you look at some of the German test methods, they demand more than one would expect from a product. The same thing is happening with certain requirements in Australia, for example. They require you to use whole blood as your soil load or organic challenge, which may be somewhat unrealistic for the type of applications these chemical germicides are meant or designed for use. And many of these test methods are too weak. They don't offer the product enough of a challenge. There is no harmonization within a given jurisdiction. This has been one of our pet peeves, that if you want to test activity against fungus, the method that you use is very different than when you use a method to test the activity against vegetative bacteria. So how can there be any comparison? You're looking at essentially comparing apples and oranges. And this needs to be addressed, and I will show you what we have done in my second talk as to address that issue. There is generally a lack of quantitation in this methodology. What you get is a yes or no answer, which is not good enough. In these circumstances, you should be able to get a proper quantitation in terms of log reductions. It is feasible. And then there is also a problem of reproducibility. No two labs give you the same result, and I'm sure as manufacturers you have experienced this frustration to then decide as to who to believe. And when you get a rejection in terms of the product's action, you cannot really ignore it either, because the regulators want to know the failures as well as successes. And then we have spent nearly 8 years to trying to develop better methods. There are problems with product labels, and there is a whole list of these. And again, this is there in your handout. I won't spend too much time on it because time is running out. But many product labels are difficult to read. They are very difficult to interpret. And again, this is not my view. I have talked to enough infection control people. And in fact, some few years ago, we presented four different infection control practitioners with a bottle of a high-level disinfectant, and we asked them to tell us how much they would dilute it for use in their own setting. Believe it or not, all four of them came up with the wrong dilution. In fact, they were diluting the product 1 in 16. They would have diluted the product 1 in 16, whereas the label said, in some convoluted terms, that the product was to be diluted 1 in 8 for use for a certain purpose. So this is just an example of how labels can lead to confusion rather than helping. Many products have a whole series of dilutions for this purpose and that purpose and different kinds of contact time, potential for confusion and misuse. Contact times and use temperatures are unrealistic. This is not entirely the fault of the manufacturer. This is the fault of standard method. For example, the AOAC method for bactericidal activity allows you to or requires a contact time of 10 minutes for an environmental surface disinfectant. Is that realistic? Who sits there to see a product work for 10 minutes? Nobody does. All you do is, in fact, take a wet mop and wipe off whatever there is, the crud or in fact, with no visible organic debris, with the contact time may last for no more than a few seconds. But then why is the product tested with a contact time of 10 minutes? Does it make sense? Will it pass muster if it is tested with a shorter contact time? I would submit that in some cases that may not be as clear-cut in that many products will begin to fail. Use temperatures. There are products which say you must use it at 25 degrees centigrade to be able to kill mycobacteria. 25 degrees centigrade is neither here nor there. Room temperature may be about 22, 23 degrees. If it was to say use 37 degrees, I can see it because you can have an incubator or a water bath, which gives you 37 degrees. But 25 degrees is a very, very difficult range to arrive at. So why does one do it? It's beyond me. Direction for application of a product can be very vague. Dilute this so much and for mopping floors. Well, how much volume of that product is to be used for what unit area? Many products do not specify it and potentially may cause confusion. And diluent is not clearly specified. And this is one very major issue that we are fighting in the sense that at the moment, the way the terminology goes, a diluent, when it says water on the label, it is meant to be distilled water because that's how the product has been tested in its germicidal testing regimen. But many cases people do not use distilled water, they use tap water. And I have experience of certain products where if you diluted them according to label directions, in distilled water they work in terms of the germicidal claim, but if you dilute the same product to the same level in tap water, they begin to fail. What does that tell you? That at best that product is marginal and that the low levels of impurities that are there in tap water are enough to be able to interfere with this germicidal activity. The current regulatory process requires many, many improvements. And again, our understanding of the process, the way it goes, it's always in a state of flux. You never can get the same people. When you pick up the phone, somebody else is sitting there, total greenhorn, and learning the whole process on the job. They're constantly short-staffed. And you can't get them to return your phone calls or email messages and so on. There is frequent staff turnovers. People who have been there for a few years, know the ropes, all of a sudden they are moved laterally or go into another division or whatever, and it totally defeats the purpose. They also have insufficient technical expertise. And so that means that the decisions that make can be subject to some questions. Chronic budgetary constraints. Every time you talk to the EPA, oh, they're short of budget, they can't do this or that. There is also a huge cultural resistance to change. And I guess it becomes a part of the civil servant psyche that everything that you have to do has to be totally immune to any potential litigation and so on. And that means that they tread the path extremely carefully, perhaps overly carefully, and that creates lots and lots of problems. And then there is inconsistency in regulation. For example, in some cases, surrogate organisms are accepted as a tradition, as a practice, to generate germicidal test data. But in other cases, they simply refuse to accept surrogates. for generating germicidal data. For example, there are no accepted surrogates for viruses, except that recently they have begun to accept the hepatitis B virus as a surrogate for human hepatitis B virus. And that's a long story, and we can talk about it for hours if the time were available. Now, what are the desirable traits in terms of a professor's point of view? As non-toxic as possible, because as I said, if it's something claimed to be totally non-toxic, I'll be very leery about that claim. Non-allergenic and non-sensitizing. And this is particularly true of things that apply to skin or go on to into the air and are possibly inhaled. Non-hormone disrupting, very important requirement. Environmentally friendly in the sense that anything you use anywhere will eventually end up in our aquatic systems, hospitals, factories, daycare centers, or whatever. Therefore, one needs to be aware of the fact that what is going to happen in terms of the environmental fate of that particular disinfecting chemical. They need to be as reasonably broad spectrum as possible for the kinds of claims that they make or the places they are recommended for use. At the moment, low-level germicides are good only against vegetative bacteria. Therefore, they should simply say that they are germicides against vegetative bacteria, but not kind of present words clothed in other context, because a disinfectant can be a disinfectant against viruses as well as bacteria. But a product says disinfectant, even though it's be tested only against certain kinds of easy-to-kill vegetative bacteria. So the activity should be broad enough for the kinds of applications that it's talking about. Fast-acting, again, we go back to that scenario where 10 minutes is certainly too long a contact time, so the contact time should be reduced. Non-staining and pungent and so on and so on. And there is a whole list free of VOCs, and this is very arbitrary. What I'm saying is that a person who's buying these things don't want to have to renew their stocks every 2 months, and if they have products that last and this point here about transportation and safety of storage, again, you may not know this, but initially when certain hydrogen peroxide based products were introduced in the US, they had problems of exploding bottles during transportation or storage. So one needs to be aware of that potential. You don't want to ruin your reputation by having something that does that. Not readily neutralized by soil load, and then non-corrosive, the material compatible and cost-effective, which is a very, very important consideration. And easy to use with very clear label directions. What can manufacturers do in terms of improving the situation? Make label directions better than they are, so that a product label is indeed user-friendly. And if it is necessary, spend some time with the user to make sure that they understand it. The problem is that there is staff turnover in hospitals and other places as well. So one needs to carry on these educational sessions on a much more regular basis. Develop safer and better formulations. And this is the crux of the matter for the summit, that we need better and safer chemical germicide. There's absolutely no question about it. And encourage users to report problems and failures. This is something we were discussing at the dinner last night, that if you have problems that have been identified, you should encourage your users to tell you about it so that you can go back and say, look, guy, there is a problem. We really need to address it. You find out about it in an indirect way, and that can, in fact, be too late in some cases. And one must lobby regulators, and this is what Ramon was saying again last night, that here is an opportunity for us to go to the EPA to tell them that, guys, get off your fat behinds and then let's do something about it, because there is a need to make changes, and we can't proceed ahead without your consent and involvement and agreement and so on. And that there must be international harmonization, because as manufacturers, you don't want to test products one way in the US, another way in Australia, and yet another way in different countries in Europe, or yet another way in Canada, if one could arrive at that international harmonization. And there are certain hopeful signs on the horizon that are actually now in effect. And then you also must open up your coffers to fund more R&D internally or in-house or externally to not only develop safer products, but also to find out if the use of germicides can be measured as producing a certain quantifiable benefit. Such data at the moment are really lacking. And unless and until we can document to say that this can be done, particularly FDA will not accept any claims, no matter what the chemical germicide might be. The future is, there are again lots and lots of different issues, but let me tell you that there will be a greater and greater scrutiny to what germicidal products will be from the general public as well as professionals, because there is an increasing awareness in that context. And an antimicrobial claim will be only one consideration. You will have to support data about safety and efficacy in a real convincing manner to be able to capture and maintain a certain market share. Test protocols need review. So these things actually go hand in hand, in a sense. And official definition of certain of these chemical germicides require changing. And again, I don't have time to go into that, but I can certainly discuss it with anyone who is interested in this. One must improve awareness in users, because they are the people who are at the receiving end of things. And as manufacturers, it's incumbent upon you to make sure that your users are properly informed and educated, and promote international harmonization. And I'm sure Diane will tell you that she is very much involved in this exercise with the OECD and so on. And I want to leave you with a Chinese saying, which says, if you don't change direction, you will get to where you're going. I'll let you figure that out, and I thank you very much for your attention.